Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as we continue to educate, as we continue to expand, going through this content, and right now our focus is the Constitution, then we're helping us, everybody, learn, pray, and act, because what's really critical is that act part, getting up off our knees and doing what we need to do. The charge is on us as citizens, just like, you know, in his kingdom, as citizens of his kingdom, the charge is on us. Therefore, let's kind of dive back into where we were, because, again, it's all about constitutional compliance. And actually, today, we actually have Tammy. We don't have Sean. And unfortunately, we've just got some schedule shifts and changes because everything wants to go sideways. It's just how it is when you're dealing with, you know, people that have lives and they're volunteering and so forth. I mean, you get your money's worth out of me, and I'm definitely getting my money's worth out of Tammy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. So let's dive into where we were. So what we ended up covering yesterday, if I remember correctly, we literally wrapped up on the 14th Amendment, and that we were then going into the 15th Amendment, because we had not covered the right to vote. Well, what I did was I kind of went down this this deep, detailed dive on Section 3, and then we identified, and we went through, actually, Section 14. Technically, we didn't read 15, or 5, I mean, Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. So that's, we could probably just do that, because it's a perfunctory line that they've started adding, which basically aligns with the Necessary and Proper Clause. But let's go ahead and do 5 real quick on the 14th Amendment. Go ahead.
Okay. The Congress shall have power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article.
That doesn't mean the Congress themselves are going to pick up guns and go out to your homes and enforce the laws here. What that means is Congress will make the appropriate legislation. It's like Congress shall make laws necessary and proper to carry forth the aforegoing powers. So instead of basically putting that in there, they put this, Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation. It doesn't mean that they can go create an enforcement agency, because the Constitution already has that agency. That is the militia. If the Congress wants to enforce laws outside of the Constitution, then those agencies that they create would be unconstitutional. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Like the IRS.
Right, or the FBI, ATM, or ATF, I mean, ATM.
And CIA. And
well, so the intelligence agencies are different. They're not enforcement agencies. They serve a different role. They're supposed to be spy. I mean, we have a need to be able to know what everybody's doing, especially our enemies. But, I mean, there is a function in national security for this thing called the intelligence network. But for it to be spying on Americans, absolutely not. For it to be doing things, absolutely not. So let's go into the 15th Amendment. This is a pretty short one. Let's go ahead.
Okay. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude.
Okay, so they say here, the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Now, when they talk about the right to vote, is that an inalienable right? It's not. If you
because you're not born with it.
That's well. So, and if you can't make it to the poll because you've got to work, you've made the choice. You can't. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I believe that to really go down and to do the election system in America more properly, I believe the states need to identify that day as a non-work day. Not a holiday where the employer has to employ you or pay you for your time, but it is a non-work day until that employee has voted. In other words, the employer cannot mandate that they have to be there at work. I don't like the idea of putting a burden on an employer to say you have to pay for somebody's time, non-productive time. But the employer has a responsibility of making sure that every citizen that works for him has the opportunity to vote because it actually protects his business. That's the way we should understand it that way. When we're protecting our rights, we're protecting our businesses as well. But anyway, so the right to vote that they're talking about here just means that if you want to vote, your desire to actually participate in this particular case, shall not be denied or abridged because of your race, color, or previous condition of servitude. That's it. In other words, the states can't create an abridgment. But guess what? The states already have these blocks. If you don't pay your poll tax, you can't vote. If you're not a man, you cannot vote. Right? So the right of, human suffrage, everybody having the right to vote, is not necessarily guaranteed, but it's still not necessarily an inalienable right. And that's what most people, need to understand, because your government is telling you that this is an inalienable right. This is why we need to start the election in July so that everybody will have the shot at being able to vote. Because they're trying to make it so open and so unreasonable. I mean, look at our governments and how much they spend on doing this. The more time the polls are open, the more money it costs. And what do we gain on that? What are we gaining? There's no reason why a person can't get up out of bed, go down to the polling place on the day of election, and vote. No reason why. And as a matter of fact, I know that in many states, the states do make sure that the employers do not inhibit a person's ability to leave work to go vote. And as a matter of fact, most employers, as I've seen it, like in California and so forth, they indicate, that you have a few hours to go out and to get into your precinct to be able to vote. That's just because the lines of the precincts get kind of unreasonably long sometimes during the day. But anyway, let's do the next article. Now, this is the 16th Amendment, and let's look for the boogeyman, and you tell me where the boogeyman is in this amendment. Go ahead.
The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration.
Okay, so they're going to lay taxes on incomes. It doesn't say persons there, does it?
Mm-mm.
It doesn't say businesses there, does it?
No.
Because that would qualify it to a specific income, personal income, a person's income, a business's income, a corporation's income, a church's income, organizational income, whatever you want to call it. What they granted themselves is the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes. If it is an income, they can tax it. Now, go ahead.
Like a tariff?
Well, so tariffs are a tax that they lay on imported goods. So in other words, a tariff is something that is applied to. It's a tax that is laid upon imports that are coming from foreign nations. That's what a tariff is. This is literally just a tax. But if you go to Article 1, Section 8, it talks about this, what we call this power of taxation. Because there's the different, so let me just get into this. This is what we call the preamble. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. Those are the types of taxes. And pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. So in other words, this whole first line and this next clause is a clarification on this. It's not a general power. This is a preamble. So this, what I've just read from the Congress to the wealth, the general welfare of the United States, common defense and general welfare, from that beginning to that ending clause, that right there is the preamble where there's a qualification on this preamble. Because it basically says that, but all duties, imposts, and excises. What's a duty tax? That's a direct tax. In other words, the direct apportionment tax on a state, that's a duty. When we look at our income tax, that is a duty tax. It is a direct tax that government is levying on the state, or now, and they changed the duty tax to being an income tax. So that's what the 16th Amendment has done. So you can just put that right there, but all incomes or taxes on income, imposts, and excises, because technically the imposts, that's where the tariffs, you know, fall under, excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So if the federal government is going to tax personal income, then the personal income needs to be uniform, not progressive. In other words, 5%. Everybody gets taxed 5%, whatever's reasonable to tax everybody. They cannot create what I would call favors for people who make less money and punishments for people who make more money. It must be uniform. Therefore, when they looked at putting the burden onto the states, they realized that they needed to make it so that they couldn't, you know, they wouldn't hurt states like Wyoming, who just joined the union. And the, I mean, where was Wyoming getting all of its money from? It didn't have a bunch of factories out there. So how was Wyoming going to be paying its taxes? Any idea?
Mm-mm.
It had to be reasonable, and that's why they apportioned it based on heads or based on people. So bottom line is the state would basically get a tax that was apportioned towards the quantity of heads. So let's just say the government was making a dollar.
It's talking about incomes that the state receives?
No. So the apportionment is a tax that was laid upon the states. That was the duty tax. The duty is the apportionment tax. And that's why the 16th Amendment changed that for duty tax or for an apportionment tax to become a direct tax, because duty tax is a direct tax on income instead of a direct tax to the state. Then in turn, the state would, because the federal government calculated, like I said, it's a dollar a person. So in the 1880s, when Wyoming was a state, the state of Wyoming only paid, you know, $60,000 because it was a dollar a head. And so they were making more money than that, but $60,000 is what they paid because it was a dollar a head. Because the federal government would lay it out a dollar a head for your state, and it was the same. They didn't give Wyoming a tax break. Oh, you only pay 50, but California, you're going to pay $3 a head. It had to be uniform. However the taxes are doled out, that tax regarding the duty tax needed to be, it's just like the excise tax. There were excise taxes that were being applied. The first excise tax that Hamilton tried to create was a tax on the transfer or the sale of horses. So every time that you would sell a horse, there would be a tax on that transaction that you would have to pay an excise tax on. It was deemed unconstitutional because it could not be uniform. Why? Because the southern states had the preponderance of all horses. Most people in the northern states didn't even own a horse. But in the southern states, almost everybody owned a horse. See? And so when they looked at how where the money was going to come from, it was going to be a tax that was going to be towards the southern states only. It needed to be uniform. So they wanted to make sure that whatever they were taxing for excise taxes, it would be an equal income or an equal burden for the people and the states, which is why they settled on taxing liquor, because everybody drank liquor, because liquor was a staple back in those days. Believe it or not, you've probably heard me say this, that the grain alcohol, because it was really fermented grain soup, and it wasn't this distilled where they, you know, extract those unwanted nutrients out of this brew, because technically the grain alcohol that they had was a brew. It wasn't moonshine. It was actually the lowest form of the fermentation of wheat whiskey, or, you know, whatever the grain is that they're doing, because it was about nutrients as well as the alcohol, because they used that to actually survive through the wintertime, because if they didn't have enough grain, you know, they at least had the alcohol, because they, even preserving things, they didn't have the ability to preserve things for long periods of time, which is why in the liquid form with alcohol, it was preserved. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So liquor was literally a staple, and there were different forms of liquor. But all distilled liquor was, because distilled liquor was considered like having your bread sandwich or having bread, because you were getting your grain for the day. You got a little tipsy with it, but anyway. But everybody, even John, so John Adams every morning had his hard cider, a good hard cider drink every morning. And that's what he believed contributed to his good health. So anyway, the point is that when we look, let's go back to the 16th Amendment. There's this requirement for the uniformity. And so when we look at the 16th Amendment, it says that from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states, and without regard to any census or enumeration. Okay, well, that's fine. But it didn't address the uniformity requirement. So had they said without uniformity, had they included and removed the uniformity requirement that was laid out in that area or in that preamble of taxation, you know, the general statement of taxation, then okay, then that wouldn't be held to uniformity. This goes to show that the people that wrote this amendment didn't understand that uniformity clause. Because by this point in time, I'm sure that the federal government had kind of abandoned that uniformity clause. That they were basically making the whatever adjustments to meet their needs instead of making sure that it was uniform. I'm sure that they were at this point in time, because we know that with the tariffs that led into the Civil War, those taxes were not uniform. The tariffs or the imposts that they were putting on foreign goods coming in were more harmful to the southern states financially than they were to the northern states. So that wasn't uniform, was it? No. So they had already started basically avoiding, because they weren't following the Constitution. So they started doing those things. And so there's no doubt in my mind, another half century later, you think they're going to be more attuned to what the Constitution says or less? Absolutely, it is going to be less, because as a society, we have abandoned, you know, making the Constitution the center of our government. And what we have done is we've created, by this point in time, the democracy had been well formed. Because what was happening, and this happened in the very beginning, and nobody was correcting this, that when the legislature, the federal or state legislatures, by a majority chose to do something, that they would get away with doing it, whether they had the power to do it or not. Because we believe that there were democracies, not limited and defined government. That makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in other words, your state legislature has no power to regulate labor or to establish a wage. In other words, set a minimum wage. It's not in your constitution. And yet the state of Wyoming has a minimum wage. And the people aren't holding up, putting up their arms going, hey, you don't have the authority to do that. And the states that have been doing that have been basically attacking businesses by telling businesses, you have to pay people a certain, which causes unemployment because the business says, I can't afford to do that. And it destroys businesses as well.
Yeah.
So the point is that they've been getting away with doing things because they went into the chambers, they voted, and they decided, oh, well, you know, we're going to do this because we all agree that we should do this, and therefore it's done. And you can't stop us because, but actually we can. All we have to do is say, well, where did you get the authority to make that law? That's not within the Constitution. Those aren't the powers we gave you. Therefore, that law is null and void. But we have to hold them accountable to that. This is where the necessity of talking about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment has to become front and center. We need to actually get states to actually start creating these standards like we talked about yesterday. And I think that was a pretty decent discussion we had yesterday. But with that, now the 17th Amendment, supposedly the other boogeyman amendment. Obviously, there's no boogeyman in the 16th Amendment. There's nowhere where they have the authority to create the IRS. No authority.
Yeah.
Enforcement, when it comes down to the enforcement within the states, that enforcement had to be done by the militia, just like the previous taxes of the whiskey tax. When we look at the whiskey tax, when they were refusing to pay it, and it had to go into true collections, those collections were handled by the militia, or I should say, the federalized militia of four states. And then those troops were sent into western Pennsylvania, and they arrested the rebel rousers on treason, tried them, and, you know, everything started moving forward again. They started actually, okay, getting their taxes on the whiskey and so forth, because everybody now was compliant. Now, it was a terrible, I don't want to say it was a terrible tax, but the way you read it, it wasn't liked because it was a tax. People felt it was like, it's like today taxing milk, right? If you tax milk, you put an excise tax on milk, you know, the parents and families are going to go, hey, this is a direct tax on us. It's an attack on us. Not just a tax, it's an attack. And so the distilled liquor was deemed the same thing. It was just, they thought it was hostile government. So anyway, all right.
Wait, can you talk about why it says questionably ratified for the 16th Amendment?
Yeah. So there's a book out there, and actually the same thing stands for the 17th Amendment, that both of them were questionably ratified. In Oregon State, the Constitutional Convention, or I should say the amendment of 1909, I think the same thing with 1912, both of these amendments reached the legislature. And I know with Oregon, it reached the legislature when they weren't in session. And there was an election, and the people that were going to vote for the 16th Amendment were removed. In other words, it became a campaign issue, and they said, we don't want you to, because we don't want you to ratify that. And so when the Oregon legislature met in January, whenever they met in 1910, the following year, because that's when it happened, the leadership, who was still the same leadership, got to remember that they were probably Republicans, and that the Republicans were still, the same people were still in control. What ended up happening is that the leadership would not seat the newly elected people. Now, with the music going over my voice, I'll just repeat this when we come back, because I understand that it's just hard to hear everything. So when I come back, I will kind of re-explain what the leadership did in the state of Oregon. We will be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so like I was just saying, when the state legislature, these new seats were being filled, or I should say, new bodies were filling the seats, the old bodies, even though they lost, showed up. And as a matter of fact, the leadership of the state legislature didn't change. They broke protocol, and instead of seating the representatives that were actually just elected to make sure that that amendment wasn't ratified, well, the old leadership basically says, we're not seating you because that amendment came in last year, and it should have been ratified or at least handled by that session, so we're basically going to convene a short mini session to ratify or to determine whether we ratify, and they did. They ratified it.
That's terrible.
So that was one state. It sounds like Wyoming, doesn't it? When Harshman did some of the things he did. Yeah, I know, but so anyway.
There's also a book called The Law That Never Was.
Yeah, is that
talks about how he believes that it was never ratified.
Yeah, is that by Bill Bennett? Something like that. I think it's Bill Bennett.
Yeah, Bill Benson, yeah.
So that's the story I believe he's told. I might have taken a little artistic license with it, but bottom line, that's why that is identified as questionably ratified.
Basically, it shouldn't be ratified because there were new representatives in there that they decided just not to place.
Right. So when you look at the original 13th Amendment, it doesn't say questionably ratified. It just says that it's been contested. In other words, it was ratified and they've contested the fact, but there's been no hardcore evidence. And as a matter of fact, there's probably been more destruction of evidence to determine whether that was ratified or not. So anyway, let's go into the 17th Amendment.
Okay.
Again, another
The Senate of the
It's another boogeyman amendment, so let's find out where the we actually wrote an article, and I just talked about this yesterday, on the importance of enforcing enforcing the state suffrage and so forth. And that article I wrote about the 17th Amendment, you know, doesn't have that boogeyman that everybody thinks it does. So let's go ahead.
All right, okay. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state, elected by the people thereof, for 6 years, and each senator shall have one vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature.
Okay, so that right there identifies how the senators are to be chosen. That one vote doesn't mean that it is their vote. They're there to represent the legislature with a single vote. That the second senator will be the second vote in representation, because again, this isn't a democracy cabinet. This is a representative body. The Senate is a representation of the state legislature. before they were chosen that way, but it was clear in Article 5 that no state could lose its equal suffrage in the Senate without their consent. And this, does you see anywhere here in this language that they were going to take away the suffrage of the state legislature?
Mm-mm.
No. They require, so the language has to be clear that we are taking away that suffrage, that this senator, with this one vote, will no longer be voting in accordance with the state legislature. That's what it would require to say that, because bottom line, when you read Article 5, it says no state, provided that no state be deprived its equal suffrage in the Senate without their consent. So that's not seeking consent. Okay, so let's go through the vacancy part.
Okay, when vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of such state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies, provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election as the legislature may direct.
Okay, so therefore, again, there's no change to who these senators are representing. There's no language to say they're no longer representing that state legislature. You know, they're basically representing the globalist, because that's what's happened. And it didn't happen legitimately. Mm-hmm. It's only happened because we have failed to actually read to say, hey, hold on here. Why are you not giving the state legislature their votes? You should be doing what they tell you to do. You're just proxy. Every person in a every legislator in a representative government in America is a proxy vote for a body of constituents. In the Senate, the body of constituents are the state legislatures. In the House, that body of constituents are the 30,000 people they're supposed to represent. Well, today it's a half a million, three quarters of a million. But that doesn't mean that that's the legitimate number. That's what Congress has taken upon themselves to do. And we've already kind of talked about
that. Every time they take a vote in Congress, all of our state senators should be telling Congress how they want them to vote.
All of our state legislatures should be telling the U.S. Senate how to vote, yes. See, Congress is both houses. You've got the Senate and
right,
the House of Representatives.
Yeah, the U.S. Senate. Yeah.
Right, okay, yeah. Just want to make sure we were being a little precise the way we needed to be. So, okay.
Yes.
So this final note shall not be construed to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as a part of the Constitution. So in other words, yeah, you'll get that last ride in the hay, whatever that is, you know, until this thing, you know, gets ratified, until it goes into effect. And then it only goes, the only change is when you seek election after it has been ratified, then you'll be seeking election instead of from the state legislature, you'll be seeking election from the people. That's all it changed, is how these senators were being appointed. So now we have the 18th Amendment. Let's go ahead and dive into this one.
Okay. After 1 year from the ratification of this article, the manufacturer, sale or transportation of intoxicating liquors within the importation thereof into or the exportation thereof from the United States and all territory subject to the jurisdiction thereof for beverage purposes is hereby prohibited.
Okay, so this is basically creating a restriction within the states of the manufacturing, shipping, and all of that of intoxicating liquors. In other words, distilled liquors. Go ahead to the next one.
The Congress and the several states shall have concurrent power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation.
Okay, so actually what they've done, because this expanded the federal government to have jurisdiction over a new crime, because basically and technically what they should have said in this, and I'll go to Article 1, Section 8, to show you what language should have actually been said, that to provide for punishment of counterfeiting the security. So in other words, Congress, that line should actually say to provide for the punishment of the manufacturing, distributing, blah, 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 because the United States has criminal jurisdiction over that. Right? So it's just like down in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 9, it says to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. So when we look at the 18th Amendment and we dive into this and say Congress should have the power to punish and define the punishment for the manufacturing, import, the importation, exportation, the transportation, whatever, they should have listed it in that manner, because they were literally giving Congress the jurisdiction over this crime, because now they created a crime. This is one of the only amendments that actually created a crime in the Union. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Because this is like treason. You do this, and well, it's not like treason, but it's a you, by violating this amendment, you are actually committing a criminal crime. Anyway, the last, go ahead and read the section 3.
Okay, this article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of the several states as provided in the Constitution within 7 years from the date of the submission hereof to the state by the Congress.
Okay,
to
so
the states by the Congress.
Okay, so what they just did in Section 3, this is the first time we've seen this. This is the first time an amendment had an expiration tag on it. In other words, if they couldn't get this amendment ratified within 7 years, which basically put an impetus and put a drive in the grassroots, the women who were on this bandwagon, we've got to get this amendment, we've got to get this amendment. So what they did was they were haranguing the state legislature, you got to ratify that. And that's, by doing that, it helped expedite, or I should say helped create urgency in the expediting of the ratification to make sure it just didn't sit there and languish. They didn't want it to just sit there. So that's why they put an expiration tag on it. Okay, so now the 19th Amendment, which is actually pretty simple. Go ahead.
19th Amendment. The right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex.
Okay, so this is just another voting amendment. One of the things that's consistent is citizens of the United States. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The reason that's important is because if it's an inalienable right to vote, then when we look at, you know, inhabitants, illegals, or what have you, then they do have a right to vote. But it is not an inalienable right. It is a right of citizens to vote. It doesn't mean that it's a protected right, that if you, you know, if you don't make it to the polls on that day of election, well, they're going to open the polls up for you again. No, no. You got one shot, and that one day in shot is, and I actually dove into this the other day, yesterday. I basically laid it out, because when you really look at it, Congress establishes the day, the national day of federal elections, to be the first Tuesday. So that's ingrained that the first Tuesday of November is when the election will occur. Just for one day. All of the states that say, well, you know, we want to have our, you know, our what we call it, two weeks of early voting and so forth, so that we can accommodate you more, that violates that federal law. Federal law is a one-day election. And for states to actually expand that, the states are actually playing this game of election fraud, or opening the door so that the election fraud can become a part of their election process. So, anyway, it's worth mentioning that. Now, this also, Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation, not meaning that they have the ability to create an enforcement agency. They have the ability to create a law to ensure that this is being enforced. The enforcement agency is still, at this point in time, we have not read an amendment that has taken the malicious responsibility of executing the laws of the union for the federal government. That's it. Okay, so this amendment, you hear me say this, how we learn more from amendments that don't pass sometimes more than we learn from amendments that do pass. This is one of them. This is an amendment that was championed by Calvin Coolidge himself, a self-proclaimed progressive. Most people think Calvin Coolidge was a hardcore conservative. No, he wasn't. He was a huge supporter of organized labor. He believed organized labor was America's future, that it was best that we protected everybody. If you've ever read his book, I mean, there's a lot of people that misrepresent him. And unfortunately, because at that point in time, Calvin Coolidge was one of the few that understood the Constitution. And he wasn't, I mean, as a man, he was a progressive. But as a president, he knew that the only way they could legitimately regulate labor was through an amendment. And him being Mr. Labor himself, he wanted to champion, and he did champion this amendment. And so let's go ahead and read this unratified amendment.
Section 1, the Congress shall have power to limit, regulate, and prohibit the labor of persons under 18 years of age.
Okay, so they're establishing a regulation on child labor. Go ahead, Section 2.
The power of the several states is unimpaired by this article, except that the operation of state law shall be suspended to the extent necessary to give effect to legislation enacted by the Congress.
Okay, so in other words, that language is a little bit different. Instead of saying Congress shall have the power to enforce this, basically it's basically saying that the states are not going to be impaired. They will remain unimpaired to be able to regulate labor. However, they're going to have to suspend a portion of their regulations. Why were they going after kids? Why did they want to make sure that kids, wouldn't be, out working for the family?
Good question.
Because they wanted to create, because if you understand, if all of a sudden, as a child, you don't have to work, that's empowering. In other words, the most important lesson that we teach our children is the importance of an honest wage for an honest day's work. And teaching children to be self-sufficient in going out and working and earning their own wage is important. And when you have the society that says, we're not going to allow you to do this to your children.
Well, except for the children, 5 years old, working in factories.
Yeah, and so that was up to the parents. And that was acceptable for years and years and years. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to get government to actually start going into this controlling of children. This was opening the door into the family and regulating families. Because when you look at the majority of families, you say factories, the majority of families, children working, were working on their farms or the family business, which was either working in the fields agriculturally, or they're working on livestock, or both, and or a multitude of different things. Because the children, the parents, for the hundreds of years, parents have had children that as soon as those children could prove themselves capable of carrying the milk, through the barn to where it needed to go without spilling it, then the kids would, okay, great, you can do that chore. And the kids were happy because they learned that they could do something.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Right.
I don't have a problem with that.
So the fact of the matter is that this amendment went out to the states and it went down in flames. The states did not ratify this amendment. This is the only language in the Constitution, or the attempted language, to grant to the federal government the ability to regulate any form of labor. Now, we had already talked about whether the state of Wyoming has in its constitution the ability to regulate labor. Right here, the federal government only was seeking the ability to regulate child labor. And yet today, they regulate all labor. How'd that happen?
Good question.
Well, it's kind of simple. The way I look at it, a majority of the legislators chose that they were going to do that, and they passed the laws, created the Department of Labor, and they just inflicted it upon the states because, you know, Calvin Coolidge wasn't going to let them do that. Wasn't going to let them pass an act. He said, no, this is an amendment. You need to at least pass an amendment. And instead, they said, you know what? And actually, if you remember correctly, if you remember at all, Teddy Roosevelt was the one that created the Department of Commerce and Labor a long time ago, in like 1906, something like that. In so doing, you know, he created the footings for the federal government to start regulating commerce within the states and labor. And as they started expanding, by the time FDR came along, he basically said, we're going to do it anyway. And this is when the courts kind of started stepping up and saying, you know, we don't like the fact that you're going this far over the line on, you know, in creating all of these regulations and enforcing all of these regulations. Therefore, Teddy Roosevelt basically says, you know what, if that's the case, I'm going to stack the court. And all of a sudden, the courts had an epiphany. The members of the Supreme Court all of a sudden said, you know what, we kind of like what you're doing. Keep it up. As we, you know, kind of analyze how we've gotten into this, it's literally been by democracy and by autocracy. In other words, you're going to do what I tell you because I'm the President of the United States. We have that today. We've had that alive and well from, Calvin Coolidge wasn't one that did it, but Hoover was, FDR was, Truman was, Eisenhower was, and Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon. We haven't had a president that has not stepped up and said, you know, I'm not gonna inflict this upon you, because even with Reagan, he did inflict regulations and so forth. I mean, Reagan was the president that actually put teeth in the EEO laws and so forth. The Equal Rights, the Equal Employment or Equal Employment Opportunity Act, whatever, EEO, where, you know, they actually started going after companies that weren't hiring blacks and so forth. And it got to a point where they were starting to establish quotas and so forth. So anyway, and it's kind of funny, because, you know, I happen to work in a career field that does not attract non-white men. When you look at engineers, the majority of all engineers are either Asian or white. I mean, it doesn't span across all ethnic groups. And so,
or Indian.
Right. So, you're talking about the Asian Indian.
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
So Asians and whites. I'm just kind of covering that with a very broad brush, Asians. So you're right, but that was it. Those were the only people that had this desire to spend a lot of time on math, you know, and inflict, you know, these headaches from solving problems and so forth. So it wasn't an easy school to get into. I mean, most people, they take the path of least resistance, political science. So when you look at the career field, when the federal government was coming in and saying, hey, you don't have enough blacks in there, you don't have enough Hispanics, you know, and you don't have enough women, they realized that they couldn't actually, you know, create engineers by just saying you got to hire these people. They actually needed an education to be an engineer. And actually, there are certifications, engineering certifications, that are very hard to get. Very hard to get. So anyway, so what they ended up doing was they started basically saying, you need to have, you need to have something that represents your demographic base. In other words, as they were coming into San Diego, where I was working, they would say, okay, you've got 12% black here. Why don't you have 12% of your workforce as black? You need to start, addressing that. That's a shortcoming. And they were trying to create regulations to where they could actually punish you for failing to meet their quotas. They knew they had a hard time getting there because, the people that had to go through that school, these demographics, they just didn't want to go through that. They didn't want to become an engineer. So, anyway, that's what we're looking at when we look at this particular constitutional amendment. We're almost out of time. We've got basically a little over a minute left. When we look at this constitutional amendment, we can actually see how they actually said, the states clearly said no. But the states have yet to stand up and say, hey, how in the heck did you get this past us? We turned you down in trying to regulate labor, and now you're regulating us. Right? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the next amendment we'll get into tomorrow will be the 20th Amendment. And this goes into, the terms of when the president will be read in and all of that. And it gets into some, nuances regarding, because they were changing. In the old days, it was March when the president came into office. They wanted to move it up closer to the fiscal year, or actually the calendar year. The fiscal year, I believe, has always been and will be in October, the 1st of October, ending at the end of September. Anyway, with that, any questions, go backs, or what have you?
Nope, not at this time.
Not at this time. All right. Well, I don't usually take the time because we don't have the time, but I want to thank you for your time and your willingness to come on and, do this reading and what have you. And I really appreciate it. I appreciate yours and Sean's willingness to help out. It's awesome.
Thank you.
And so anyway, I know that I get comments. They love you, Tammy.
Oh, wow, thanks.
Anyway, with that, folks, as we move forward, we've only got, a few more. Actually, there's quite a few more because there's a lot of amendments that never made it, like the Equal Rights, the ERA amendment, and so forth. So we still have a few more to go. And I'm going to say, for most of them, because they're really innocuous, we're just going to fly through these things. A lot of these things don't play in our everyday life. There are a few that I will do some scorched earth on, but other than that, we should get through this in the next few days. But anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.